It's Sunday. You know what that means. Recording from the Fishtown studio in sunny, but still cold, Philadelphia, PA. It's the Gaze Into the Blue Light podcast. I'm Steve.
I'm Nikki.
And every Sunday, we discuss new and notable books, movies, shows, video games, etc., etc. Anything that we find on those devices and screens, putting off that gorgeous blue light. Welcome. This week, we have a really good spread of things to talk about. If you're not familiar with the format of our episodes, we start off with a couple interesting articles that we found online this week, talk about those for a little bit. Then we each bring something new or notable to review and discuss. Could be a movie, could be a show, a book, anything really. As long as it can be found on a screen or a device of some kind. This week we have the brand spanking new movie on Netflix, I Care a Lot. We'll be talking about that, can't wait. I'll also be bringing Breaking the Rules again this week. I'll be bringing a new novel called A Children's Bible by Lydia Millett. And Nikki will be talking about the notable book this week called Oreo.
Yes.
By Fran Ross. A real quick note before we get started. This podcast is 100% listener supported by listeners like you. That means no promo codes, no ads, nothing like that. The only sponsor is listeners. So if you're interested in supporting for as little as 99 cents a month, you can go to two places now. One, you can go to this show's description, wherever you're listening to your podcast, and you can click on the link that says support this podcast, and it'll take you to a quick and secure place to support for as little as 99 cents a month, which is mere pennies.
Yes.
Or shillings.
Shillings.
Or pence, depending on where you live. Also, you can, if you're like, I don't really know you, but I will buy you a cup of coffee or a pint of beer or something like that. You can head to Venmo and you can find us there at GIBL Podcast. And because of the amazing supporters that we do currently have, we have a new addition. We have a website, GIBLpodcast.com.
Amazing.
And because of the listeners' generous support, we can afford to have a website hosted for a year.
I should also say that because of your hard work on your day off, you completely designed a website.
Well, it's not hard work necessarily when it's fun for me.
Yeah, you like it.
I did enjoy it. But
it looks great.
Thank you. So I encourage our listeners to head over to GIBLpodcast.com. It's going to be kind of the show's main hub. And it is that hosting, yearly hosting fee is paid for by generous listener support. So
thanks,
thank you
guys,
for that. So that's going to be a place where I'll have every episode of the show, original artwork for each episode that I'm working on. Show notes, kind of like longer descriptions about the shows, helpful links, etc. So yeah, that's just going to be kind of a main hub. I don't know what else will go there, but a website is a good place to start adding interesting things. And
yeah,
if there's something that you like on the websites, let us know. A contact form, there's one of those on there.
Contact.
Etc. So head over to the website and check that out if you want. So thank you to our generous sponsors. And that's really where sponsorship goes. If you give us a donation, this is not how we make our living, obviously. But it is, you know, we'll like do stuff with the website. We might get into the merch game. We might get microphones, editing type things. So
can make little tiny like tasting glasses, like tiny pint glasses.
I would love that. Little tiny pint glasses, coffee mugs, etc.
Love it.
The ubiquitous stickers. Tote bag.
Oh, gotta have a tote bag.
Gotta have a tote bag. Anyway, so that's where your generous support is going. So thank you for those of you that are already supporting us and those of you that are thinking that you might. All right, that was really exciting.
Woo!
Let's get to the show. Okay, welcome. You want to get to your article?
I would love to get to my article. My article's from the New York Times, as usual. Sorry, I have to preface this with I am slightly obsessed with the New York Times, and I think that we are, like, in sync. Because didn't this week I told, or there were like two separate times where I asked you a question, and then the next morning in my email there was an article from the New York Times that asked, they answered my question, and I was like, oh my god, they are reading my mind and answering my questions. Do you remember what I even asked you? One thing was about it was about the vaccine, remember? And then I woke up and I showed you that article about the vaccine alarmism, and it was just essentially talking about like extremes of people that believe in the vaccine or don't, and also people who take like staying at home and things to like an extreme level and those who don't. So that was interesting. And what was the other, there was one other question I asked you and then I woke up, maybe I texted it to you and I was like, oh my god, they're reading my mind again. I don't want to waste too much time on this, but it was strange and remarkable that it happened two times and they answered me. They answered my question in my inbox in the morning. Oh, it was called COVID absolutism, not vaccine alarmism. COVID as absolutism. I can't remember the other one, but it doesn't matter. At any rate, my challenge for next week will be to bring an article that's not from the New York Times.
Good challenge.
You heard it here first. Okay. So my article this week is about, let me find it. Okay. Article this week is called VHS Fans Take the Opportunity to Rewind. Nostalgia for the 1980s and a vast library of available titles are alluring to a certain group. This kind of reminded me of your 80s knowledge rant from your novel from last week. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, this is like, so what would be in that book, the Ready Player 2? So, interesting fact, the last VCR, do you know when, like what year it was produced and where? Take a guess. The last VCR. When was it produced? We'll start with that. What year?
2001. In China.
Good guess. 2016 by the Funai Electric in Osaka, Japan.
2016.
I know. Shocking, right? I didn't think it would be that late. The VHS tape itself may be immortal. So there has become a trend now, especially on Instagram, it appears, with people posting about VHS and also selling them for high, high prices. There was a limited edition copy of The Little Mermaid. How much do you think they were asking for it on Etsy?
The VHS copy?
The VHS copy.
I still remember the Disney cases. They were like big and white.
Yes, they were so like thick plastic, right?
Yeah. How much do...
Those are just sitting in landfills, I guess.
Yeah. Or people... I would
people
wager
that
quite a,
held on to them.
Quite a few people still have their Disney VHS.
My mom still has like all of our VHS tapes from growing up.
I don't know, $50?
Oh god, no. Oh, God, no. $45,000.
For what?
For The Little Mermaid, limited edition copy, VHS. $45,000 on Etsy.
That's absurd.
Anyway, so, you know, there have been people, like you said, who have collected them, people who sell them, but I think, you know, it seems like it's turning into, like, a nostalgic thing now that we have the streaming services. It was talking about how, you know, you can have kind of everything at your fingertips, but the VHS, and back when there were stores, kind of gave more of an opportunity for access to everyone to be able to have those, like equal access, if you will, to a VHS store. Whereas like streaming services, like there's so many of them. And so if you want to be up with all of the latest movies, you have to be on like 10 different streaming services, which is probably like $100 a month or more. And so it really limits people's ability to access new movies and entertainment. Whereas anyone could go to the VHS store and rent VHS, which I don't even remember how much they cost to rent at this point. I couldn't even guess.
There's still a Blockbuster.
Yes, I was gonna bring that up. So, I don't know. There's not a whole lot else, you know, to note. It was just kind of a fun, cute article to read. Nothing, like, earth-shattering. But, so the VHS was originally developed in Japan in 1976 and brought to the United States in 1977 and essentially discontinued in 2006. So I thought that was kind of interesting, those dates that I was not entirely sure of. It also talks about the home videos that were captured on VHS. Did your family do home videos growing up on VHS?
No.
Oh my God. See, we did. We have countless numbers of VHS tapes at my house. My mom would do like opening Christmas gifts, birthdays, dance recitals, all manner of things on VHS, and it's so fun to be able to go back and watch those things. It really talks about the tactile sensation and like the experience of going in to a store and actually selecting a movie. And I was just thinking about that in comparison to the experience we have now, which is just like sitting and looking at Netflix, and for me at least, feeling like completely overwhelmed of like, oh my God, like what do you even pick? Like, what do you even watch? And I was trying to think back, like, did I have that same experience going into a video store to rent a movie? Was it that overwhelming to walk in and look around? And I don't think that it was, because I think that when I went to a video store, it was for something very specific, which was something that just came out. And so I knew that, like, oh, this movie just came out, I'm going in there to get this.
Which they could all be checked out.
They could all be checked out.
Which was really annoying.
Super annoying.
If it was a big hit and you really wanted to see it and you went there and they had like the copy on the shelf and you run over to it and grab it and there'd be no cassettes behind it because they were all checked out. Which was like, I was gonna say the worst, but it really isn't the worst. But
yeah,
that was irritating.
Yeah,
it really. And then you have to walk around the store because you went all the way to the store and find something else.
To get that specific thing, yeah. Could you ever like call and get something put on hold? Like you were like, oh, I just need Ghostbusters. Can you put it on hold for me? Like I don't know if they did, used to do that. Maybe. I imagine they would maybe, or if you knew, maybe you knew someone that worked at the video store, you could totally call in and be like, hey. Put that Ghostbusters away for me. I'm coming in. I don't know why I'm obsessed with Ghostbusters. Anyway, they're talking about, you know, the home videos, and it made self-documentation readily available. So if you think about that, it was sort of like the original, I don't know, TikTok or what were those Instagram things called? Stories, like videos. And so people that, you know, are nostalgic for VHS are really hoping that they'll make a comeback and that that self-documentation will make a comeback. But the thing I'm wondering and that I'm sort of concerned about is that if VHS players have been discontinued and haven't been made since 2006, maybe there's a bunch of VHS tapes available, but not enough players available.
Oh, I'm sure there's... You can find them.
On the internet.
On the internet, or at a...
Like, for a lot of money.
Goodwill or whatever.
Right. Because I would think that the VHS players would not work as well as the VHS tapes, because think, you're using a player over and over and over again, whereas you're only using a tape like once every couple months or year, so they get more use, so I imagine they might not be as good in working order. I would like to point out that walking around our neighborhood in Fishtown, do you remember seeing, so everyone knows about these like little libraries that people have. It kind of looks like a birdhouse, and it's a lending library, and you put books in it. There is a Blockbuster one in our neighborhood that has VHS tapes in it.
I did not know
that. I don't know how I'll find it. It's one of these things that I just like stumble upon on long walks, like, you know, kind of rambling. I'll take a picture of it. I'll try to find it. But I did want to tie into what you brought up, which was there is the last Blockbuster in the world. We know this, but many people might not know, is located in Bend, Oregon. And so some people make like a, you know, a trek there to see this last Blockbuster. I guess they've been trying to survive during the pandemic. They were actually offering sleepovers through Airbnb and selling merchandise. Isn't that cool?
That's funny.
But it is the last Blockbuster in the world.
They have a really funny Twitter account.
Do they?
By the way, yeah.
Hmm. Anyway, that's it cool. Looks like a really cool place. Sadly, we never visited there. This says prices remain the same, with movies retailing for $3.99 for a 3-day rental, new movies, and older movies are 99 cents for a week-long rental. Late fees are still a thing.
That was always annoying when you wanted to check a movie out, and the clerk was like, you know, you owe $12. Can't check it out until you pay that. And you're like, oh dang it. I remember Family Video, you used to be able to be like, oh, I'll pay it next time. And then they would let you check it out up to a certain point. Mm-hmm. But that was always
what? Wait, I returned that.
And then they'll be like, no, you actually returned Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure 4 days late. Like, no, I lost that one under the couch. And that's why. I also remember we used to have it was shaped like a Corvette, or no, maybe like a 57 Chevy or something. It looked like a car, and you slid the tape in and press it down, and it was a fast rewinder. Fast rewinder, yeah.
Yes.
Those were good.
This article made me happy. I know. It was just like nothing like super notable or remarkable or earth-shattering. It's not like landing on the moon or anything, but it was just something kind of that made me feel nostalgic for VHS and Blockbusters and video stores and video rentals. My friends and I, when we were like seniors, I think Sex and the City was just coming out, and so we were naughty and we would like go rent it and watch it at my friend's house. We weren't allowed to rent it, probably. Or I think, wait, one of our friends was 18, so maybe she could rent it, but we thought it was like super naughty to be watching Sex and the City.
Yeah. At the neighborhood Eagle video, yes. My dad would write a note saying, Steven's my son, you can allow him to rent a rated R movie.
Oh my god.
And I would go and check out like the kickboxer movies.
That's hilarious.
Like the fighting movie, fighting and ninja movies. I was allowed to watch those. So.
Oh my god, that's so funny.
I would go and get like the Terminator or like, you know, action movies like that. And I would show my note and they'd be like, okay, fine.
Oh my god, that's so funny.
Back in the day. Okay, well, good article. Back in the day. Good article. That the link to that article will be put in our show notes if you want to read up on that. My article is, well, as you know, if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you know that I'm catching up on all the Marvel movies. Mm-hmm. I am up to Black Panther.
Wow.
Which is pretty close. I've only got like 4 or 5 left.
Whoa.
Yeah. So I've been trying to catch up on all those. Something that I realize that I have not been following up with is the DC comics universe.
Huh.
So that's the other kind of the other big competitor comics universe, which is Batman, Superman, The Flash, Wonder Woman.
Okay.
Aquaman.
What streaming service would these be on? Disney Plus?
They're on HBO Max.
Oh god.
Yeah, so we're gonna have to get HBO Max. But the big news this week out of the DCEU, DC Entertainment Universe, perhaps? There's a new Flash movie, a movie for The Flash, coming out in November of 2022. And it's notable for a couple of reasons. One, which is what this article is about, it's called The Flash Movie Casts DCEU's Supergirl. And the Supergirl is Kara Danvers, a.k.a. Supergirl. The actor that's going to be playing her is Sasha Calle or Calle. I'm not sure. It's the double L, so I think it's Calle.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's going to be making her debut as Supergirl in The Flash, the standalone movie for DC. And it's notable because... she's the first Latina to be playing the role.
Wow.
Which is really
That's
cool.
That's great.
And so that is getting a lot of hype. And also, so she's a woman of color playing Supergirl. And the other notable thing is that Batman will be in The Flash movie.
Really?
Played by Michael Keaton.
No.
Yeah.
What?
So he is going to be appearing as Batman in The Flash movie.
Wow.
Which is exciting for me because when Michael Keaton played Batman, that was probably the first big superhero movie that I looked like.
Mm-hmm.
Went crazy for, and I think I was 11 or 12 years old, and I went to see it with my dad in the theater, and that first one, like, I was, like, Batman crazy.
Yeah.
With Jack Nicholson as the Joker.
Ooh.
And then the follow-up, Batman Returns, with Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman.
Oh my gosh.
Danny DeVito as the Penguin.
Oh, he's so gross as the Penguin.
So gross in that movie. Tim Burton directed. Oh. It's, those two movies are still, some of my favorite superhero movies ever. So I was really excited
Great
about that.
Great cast.
Yeah.
Superstar cast.
So that means that now I need to get back into the DC movies, of which I have not been paying attention to them at all.
Well, now you have a new goal, a new project.
I know. I need to finish my Marvel movies, and then switch over.
Yeah.
To the DC movies, I've seen a lot of the Batman movies.
Yeah.
I've seen all the Batman movies, Batman Begins, and all of those, The Dark Knight, and all of those. I've seen them. But I haven't seen any of the Wonder Woman movies. I did watch Aquaman on a plane, I think.
Yeah, I didn't watch that.
And then I know nothing about the Flash movies or the Flash. I know the Flash has a series right now, and it's really popular.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is it on Netflix?
I think so.
Huh.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But I've heard it's good, but I haven't been paying any attention. There is a little bit of competition, although I wouldn't even call it a little bit of competition. Like, the Marvel Universe far outperforms anything by DC.
Oh, and people might not like that.
Well, I think there are fans of both, but I don't know that it's much argument that Marvel has, like, killed it with the movies and the shows lately.
That's fair.
And they have been on a hot streak. Although there is a new a DC movie coming out in March on HBO.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think it's, so like, I could be wrong, but Marvel has the Avengers, and DC, I think they call it like Justice League
or
something. And that's Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman and Aquaman and The Flash.
Okay.
Sorry, comics people, but I think I'm right. Either way, I need to get into those and learn more about that universe. So I'm excited about getting into some of the comics and following along with that. And I'm so excited about a little bit more diversity and people of color in the cast.
Yeah, I love that.
Which will be
what Black Panther was, really. Groundbreaking.
Black Panther was pretty groundbreaking when it came out. It made like a huge splash, and and the new Miss Marvel is the first. I talked about that on an earlier episode. The first Miss Marvel, who's a Muslim, the first female comic book character that's a Muslim to headline her own series of comics. So I feel like things are exciting, and this is over the course of the past, you know, 5 years or so. Things are starting to open up that way. So I'm excited about that.
That is exciting. Speaking of that, I would just like to note what I said to you earlier, which was, hold on, let me grab it. Sorry for that groaning. That's like how I am when I get up and sit down now, because I'm old. Like, hold on a minute. Gotta get up. I did want to note that one of my longtime favorite magazines, Bon Appetit, who they got into some, I guess, controversy during the pandemic of, like, exploiting people of color in terms of not paying them as much as white people for their recipes and cooking and contributions, and just for being very white in their focus and spotlight of chefs and restaurants, etc. They have just hired for this, let me see, March 2021 edition, they introduced their new editor-in-chief, Dawn Davis, and she is a Black woman, and so that's very exciting. She's very committed to, diversifying the storytelling, diversifying the history, the restaurants, the chefs, etc. And I will say that just in, you know, I didn't read the whole episode, but just in a quick look through, it did seem like there was, like, a lot more diversity just in different spotlights and articles. So thought that was good to note.
That's very good to note, yeah.
On the same, you know, page is what you were talking about.
On the same page. Literally. Yeah.
Love it.
Awesome. Okay, two great articles. We talked about VHS tapes.
Woohoo!
And Be Kind Rewind. We also talked about the new expanding DC Universe movies that are coming up and their cast, which is going to be exciting to follow. And that'll be a fun discussion to talk about how they measure up against the Marvel Universe that is already very strong right now. When we come back after we take a quick break, we will review and discuss new Netflix movie, I Care a Lot, yes. And a couple of really good books.
Yes.
See you shortly.
Exciting break.
That was a very exciting break, filled with lots of exciting activities.
Like standing in the kitchen eating?
I ate some peanuts.
I ate a string cheese.
I went to the bathroom.
Same.
I don't know how people do podcasts without taking a break. They probably take a break and they just edit it to make it seem like they don't take a break.
Mm-hmm. Tricky.
Not on this one.
No, we keep it real.
Yeah. Let's see. So we are in the portion of our show where each of us brings something to the table. Mm-hmm. New or notable books, movies, TV shows, mm-hmm. games, comics, who knows what. And we give it a quick review and discuss mm-hmm. it. I frequently break the rules. Mm. You always follow the rules.
Yep.
But I feel like this time we wanted to break the rules a little bit and bring three things because we watched a great movie on Netflix, I thought.
Yes, called, I thought it was so good.
It's called I Care a Lot, and it was available for streaming on February 19th.
Friday.
Which was Friday. So it just came out. You may see it on your Netflix screens. As of yesterday, it was number one in the top 10 mm-hmm. on Netflix. And we watched it last night. Just as a quick background, it was just available. It premiered at the 2020 Toronto International Film Festival. It's been getting pretty good reviews. It has a couple of nominations on the Golden Globes, whoa. Which are coming up on February 28th, mm-hmm. which is exciting. I think
that
exciting. We should do a watch party.
We always do that.
Bottle
we
of bubbly.
We always dress up. I like to dress up.
And Amy Poehler and Tina Fey are hosting.
I love that.
Maybe we should do a special Golden Globes episode.
Yeah, we should.
That would be fun.
I would love that. I always love to do like snacks and champagne and wear a dress.
I'll talk to our producers.
Okay.
About the sounds feasibility good. Of that.
All right.
So, I Care a Lot is starring, I had the cast
Rosamund
here.
Rosamund Pike.
Rosamund Pike as the main character, Marla Grayson. And the can never go wrong, Peter Dinklage.
Love him. Game of Thrones. Big Game of Thrones fan.
So, Peter Dinklage is I thought his character was really cool.
It was so good.
And Eliza Gonzalez as Fran, I thought she was really good as well. Those are kind of the main
characters.
The three main characters. And also Diane West, who's Jennifer Peterson.
Who yes.
Really good as well.
I love her.
A brief synopsis. Marla Grayson is a professional court-appointed guardian for dozens of elderly wards, and it's kind of her con in a way
mm-hmm.
where she kind of gets doctors to say that older people can't take care of themselves and the court appoints her as their legal guardian.
Yeah.
And then she proceeds to take guardianship over them, move them out of their house, and make money off of them, and charge them.
Yeah.
Charge them money for all the services that she's offering.
Right.
So she, as the movie starts off, she's like, you know, flying high. She's really good at what she does. I thought she played her character really, really well.
She was so good. Everyone was so, we talked about this, so wicked and bad. Everyone was bad. There was no one good in the movie.
It was one of those movies where yeah, no one is good. It was kind of like a heist or a crime movie where like everyone is doing something bad.
Yes.
But you have to find someone to kind of pull
for. To, like, root for?
Yeah.
Who were you rooting for?
Peter Dinklage, of course.
Oh, well, yeah.
So,
I was rooting for the ward. What's her name again?
Oh, Jennifer something. Roberts, or, I don't know. Hold on. Jennifer
Roberts. She was so good.
Jennifer Peterson.
She did a great job.
So basically, Jennifer Peterson is one of the elderly people, mm-hmm. and this doesn't spoil too much. This all kind of happens
within
the first...
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I don't want to spoil anything too much because it just came out Friday.
So Jennifer Peterson, we could safely say that, you know, the main character, this shark of a woman who mm-hmm. is running the con,
yeah.
Being the guardian, Marla, she gets a tip on, mm-hmm. they called her a cherry.
A cherry,
like
yes.
An elderly person with no strings attached.
No children,
lots of savings.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, pull their guardianship con on her, and it ends up being not a very good decision.
Not a good choice.
But yeah, I thought some positives from the movie were the acting. I thought
yes.
everyone was just downright bad. And I liked
so
it.
So good at
they
being
were,
bad.
They were so good at being bad. It was kind of like a guilty pleasure to watch the movie and just be like, this is just all bad and it's just not going to end well.
Yeah. It was like a very eye candy movie, like luxurious, beautiful, good scenes, good scene cuts.
I thought it was very, pleasing to watch. Lots of eye candy. It was like clean, crisp.
Her vaping was always like a good like scene transition. Like it reminded me of your favorite scene transition in The Big Lebowski where he like takes a big hit of that joint when he's meeting with mm-hmm. the guy about saving Bunny.
Best scene
smooth transition.
Well,
dude,
we just don't know. Yeah, she really played the vape pen really well. And I think that's kind of one of the ways that, I don't know, her acting was just really solid.
It was solid.
And there was a really cool kind of juxtaposition between her as like this really tall, good-looking blonde woman and mm-hmm. Peter Dinklage.
Yeah.
Who's like, you know, obviously shorter. And he has like the long black hair, long black beard. He's like really evil looking. And
mm-hmm.
she has this huge, amazing smile with all these beautiful white teeth.
And that haircut.
That
sharp.
Crisp blonde haircut. And
she's like a sharp bob.
Yeah.
Good style, stilettos.
Yeah, I thought the story was good.
Mm-hmm.
It kept me interested the entire time.
Oh,
my
yeah.
attention did not waver.
No.
And it wasn't predictable all the way to the very end.
I love the ending.
I thought I had a great ending.
I'll not give the ending away, but it was good.
I thought it was satisfying.
Very satisfying ending. It was not like a minute before the ending, I was like, I'm going to be kind of pissed with how this ends. But then I thought that it was the people get what they deserve at the end.
Yeah, and I felt like all in all, for a Friday night Netflix, or wait, Saturday night Netflix
mm-hmm.
couch, like you were saying earlier, it's like there are so many different choices. There's lots of things to choose from. And you're like, well, just start it and see. If we don't like it, we can always just turn it off or whatever. Like, from the second we hit play, I was in.
I was in, too.
And when it was over, I felt like, you know what? That was a quality experience.
Yeah.
And I felt like...
Two hours well spent.
Yeah, I felt like it was time well spent. It was a good
mm-hmm.
movie. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I loved it.
Highly recommend. I care a lot.
It was so... Did it terrify you in some ways about being in a... elderly care facility?
Well, what was scary was it doesn't seem like it's entirely illegal what she was doing.
Well, I don't know. We'd have to do some research to see how true this is.
Well, the illegal part, you know, obviously, yeah, there, it was a con. It is against the law to do that stuff. But the you know, the legal process behind being an older person's guardian, it could be kind of scary for a lot of people. And like, she shows up at her door, is like, I've been appointed as your legal guardian, come with me. And you're like,
God. It just made me think, like, because in the movie she doesn't have kids, you know, and so there's no one to appoint to be her guardian. So that's what happens, is the doctor appoints this, you know, wicked lady to be her guardian. I was thinking, you know, for us, for people who don't have kids, I was like, well, geez, I don't want somebody showing up to my house and getting me. But I mean, also, that's a terrible reason to have children, is to think that someone's going to be there to take care of you. I highly recommend don't have kids for that reason, but
not only for that reason. No.
Right. Not only for that reason.
Well, I did think it was scary, because that thing is something that we're all gonna, not everyone, but for the most part, a lot of people will have to think about, you know, when they themselves or their parents aren't able to take care of themselves and that process of moving in. And
it
I think
it's a scary thing to think about.
The eye-opening part for me was all of the money that's involved in that whole process. Is like, it seems like it's just a huge business of making money off of older people that can't take care of themselves.
Right, right. Well, because she sells, like, their homes, their cars, like, all their belongings, and it is quite expensive to be in one of those care facilities.
Yeah, I thought it was, the movie deals with some current issues that are topical.
Absolutely.
So I would,
I'd give it
I'd give it a highly recommend on the gaze into the blue light recommendation scale. Yeah. Anyway, good stuff. I Care a Lot on Netflix. You should check it out. We both liked it. We now come to the part of the show where we each bring something to the table to discuss and review. Do you want to go first?
Sure. Oh, you always let me go first. You're so nice.
That's the one nice thing I do all week, is let you go first.
Okay.
Mostly because I have no idea what it is, this book that you've been reading. And I have no clue what it is, and I'm interested to learn about it.
That's really interesting. Okay, so this is a book called Oreo by Fran Ross. This was another book that I learned about on the Women Who Travel podcast. They talk about a lot of books, so... Or at least they have been during the pandemic when they cannot travel. So this was a really interesting sounding book on the podcast. So I purchased this from a local bookstore. So basically, Oreo, she's raised by her grandparents in Philadelphia, which was one of the things that I was excited about.
This is a fiction story?
Yes. She has a black mother and a Jewish father who disappeared when she was an infant, but he left behind a mysterious note with clues on how to find him and the story of her birth. So it's sort of it's a modern parody of the Odyssey of Theseus, which I don't know anything about that.
Okay.
The classical Odyssey of Theseus. Do you ever really heard of this? I don't know either. We'll have to look it up. But it's a parody of that. And so with, of course, a feminist twist, she's a young female character. It's from the 70s. So there's a lot of 70s culture. It's the copyright 1974. I believe this was Fran's first and only book. Interesting fact about her is that she was a writer for Richard Pryor.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. So is it kind of funny? Are there some jokes?
It's funny, yeah. I guess, so one of the things about this book was it was kind of hard to get into and keep up with a little bit, just because it switches between like standard English, Black vernacular, and Yiddish. And so the jokes kind of span across all of those things, and so I felt like I didn't always get the like cultural references, or I wasn't always completely understanding of the language. But I also thought that was one of the most interesting things about the book, actually, was the way that it was written like that. It was overall just a really kind of fun book, like an adventure of her going out as a young woman to try to find her father in New York. So she travels from Philadelphia to New York to try to find him with this letter that has a bunch of different clues in it. And so she meets some really like unsavory underground, underbelly, like New York characters in like recording studios and brothels. She gets herself into some, you know, situations that are probably quite shocking for a young woman traveling for the first time on her own. I really like that, like the adventure of it and just the mystery and the clues of her trying to find her father. And she does actually eventually find him, but then there are some twists that I won't give away. Mm. The ending was kind of strange, and I still feel like I don't entirely know what happened, and it may have some parallels with this classical Odyssey, and so I probably need to look that up to see if that might resolve some of the mystery for me. I liked that. I liked the adventure. I liked that she was a young female lead. I liked the way that it was written because it kind of read like a play and it was broken down. I've been really liking books that are broken down into these like very short chapters that are sort of like either journals, like All the Light We Cannot See. It was broken down into very short like journal type chapters, and this was broken down into like play scenes almost, the way it's written. So I liked that. It would be like Oreo waiting for the subway, Oreo at the payphone, like those are the headers of the play scenes, if you will. I thought it was funny and interesting that since it is written in the 70s, there are no cell phones, and so I thought that was kind of apparent, like in her like being on the train, being on the subway, waiting at certain places, and it kind of talks about the things that she does to pass time. And I was just thinking about how interesting that is, because now when we're anywhere waiting to pass time or like on a subway or a train, we probably have our heads in our phones, but you know, she couldn't do that. So she would just be like looking at all the people and like analyzing their noses and like talking about who had the best nose or something, like in her head doing this, or like counting tiles on the floor, like just those kinds of things that she would do to sort of pass the time. So I thought that was interesting. What else?
Were there lots of good kind of, because New York and Philadelphia are both cities with a lot of personality.
Mm-hmm.
Were there like landmarks and stuff?
No, not so much landmarks. I think it's more like the people that she meets are kind of the remarkable parts of it. Like the people that she interacts with on her journey of trying to find her dad, those were more of the interesting parts, I would say. She has some really interesting interactions with some really strange folks, which so, I also think is something that you can have, especially if you use public transit and you are not closed off. By that I mean you don't have headphones in and you're not with your head in your phone. If you're just sitting at a bus stop or like sitting on the subway, you know this, and you're not absorbed in something, people will interact with you and the interactions will usually be really weird. Right?
Yeah, so it's less kind of focused on the places,
mm-hmm,
and more on the people of,
yeah,
the different places.
I would say it's more focused on the characters. I think what I was a little bit disappointed with, or that I thought just from like the description that it would be more focused on, was like the intersectionality of her identity as like a Black Jewish young woman, and I was hoping for them to kind of explore that a little bit more, and I don't feel like they did, but...
So the title, Oreo, is a description of her.
Yes, and so that's why I thought there would be, like, more focus on that. And I think there was, in terms of just, like, her different family members, and just, like it says, you know, the different, like, language and culture and communication used. I think you do get a sense of it there. But, yeah, the front of the book is, like, looks like an Oreo cookie. Like, the O's are both black, and the R and the E are white, so... Yeah, I thought there would be a bit more about that, which there wasn't, but maybe it is there, but just in a more, like, subtle way, and less in, like, a, you know, like a, what do I want to say, sociocultural textbook examination of intersectionality.
Yeah, that's, it's also seems like it's a good story, like that's a really
it is a good story.
That always serves as a good plot of mm-hmm. like you get this map or these series of clues yeah. and you have to make it to yeah. to the end.
Exactly. I mean,
that is readable, right? Mm-hmm. Because you know where it's going.
Yeah. Exactly.
And sometimes a nice predictable plot in that way is good, especially if it takes you through some interesting people and places.
Mm-hmm. Overall, it was a very interesting book. I've never read anything like this before, you know, which was another reason that I wanted to read it. You know, I'm trying to read more books by authors that I may not normally read from, like The Convenience Store Woman was a Japanese author and a Japanese written short novel. This is by a black female author, so you know I'm trying to kind of branch out and expand my literary horizons, so I thought this definitely did that.
That is a noble pursuit.
Yeah, thank and you.
That is one of our main tenets here yeah, at the Gaze Into I the Blue so. Light podcast.
So yeah, I recommend this. I highly recommend this. You should read it and tell me, and then we can talk about it.
Okay, the book is Oreo. It's by Fran Ross. Mm-hmm. I'll put it on our Goodreads profile. That's where you can find all information about all the books that we've covered on the Gaze Into the Blue Light podcast. I'll also put a link for it in our show notes with a little bit more info about it if you want to explore it a little bit. Well, that was a good thing to bring to the table.
Thanks.
I saw you reading it, and I had, like, no idea what that was about, but it's interesting. Okay, now is the time when I bring something to the table.
Love it.
I also brought a book. This book was recommended to me by a longtime listener, Robert.
Oh, nice.
Of the Northwest.
He
recommended this book to me and said that it would make a good podcast discussion.
Ooh, okay.
We'll see if he's correct.
All right. I love it.
No, this is the true test.
Okay.
The book is called A Children's Bible, and I have to say, when I got the text from him asking me if I've read A Children's Bible yet, I was a little bit confused.
Oh, did you see my eyebrow raise?
And like, rightly so. But what? This is not a Bible, as in the Bible of okay. the Christian religion. But there are some really interesting connections.
Okay.
So the book is called A Children's Bible. It's a novel by Lydia Millett, and it's, I guess, Wikipedia puts it in the genre of climate fiction, which is new to me.
That's new to me.
It was published in May of 2020, 240 pages, so it was a pretty quick read.
Okay.
I had to cruise through it pretty quick on my Kindle, but very current. Right, so May of 2020 is like,
yeah.
you know, the things that are discussed in the book are right on with where we are right now.
Okay.
It's climate fiction. Basically, it is the experience of a group of children of various ages. They go into their high teens, and then some of them are as young as 5 or 6, and then eventually there is a newborn baby that is involved with their group. And they kind of face down climate change. So it's a really interesting look at how young people, teenagers specifically, since the main character and narrator of the book is a teen girl who's 14 or 15, I'm not sure. And her name's Eve. She's the novel's narrator. And the whole kind of story is focused on the group of kids and their interactions with adults in terms of the coming climate disaster. So in the book, they are all at a at the beginning of the book, the parents and kids are all at a vacation home.
Okay.
And they're kind of doing like a week long vacation, and all the parents are hanging out together, and then the kids like separate themselves and they all hang out together. So it's the kind of main group is the kids, and the adults are seen as kind of like not villains necessarily, but as a teen or a kid looks at a group of adults, which is like everything they say is absurd.
So annoying.
Is so annoying and so stupid and doesn't make any sense. And everything they do is a dumb waste of time. And any request that they make or question they ask is totally out of left field and
trying to ruin my life.
And trying to ruin my life. And so it's really interesting because for work, I interact with young adults all the time, and it really is true that, like, it doesn't really matter what genius things you have to say or what amazing wisdom you have to impart. Like, it's dumb.
Yeah,
it's
stupid. They're not having it.
And it's like, listen, this book is so good. Seriously, you guys, like, this is good. What did you think of the ending? And then just, like, crickets. We went over the book of Mice and Men, which has an incredible ending, a shocking ending.
And lots of cursing.
It does have lots of cursing. But
I mean, kids would like that, wouldn't they? Sorry.
That's the thing, is that you think that a young person's going to like it.
Yeah.
And like, oh my God. And even if they did like it, or even if that ending totally blew them away, they're not going to tell you it did. No. Because to give you the satisfaction of being right is like the ultimate. Can't do it.
I don't know how you, sorry, just a side note, I don't know how you deal with that, and I don't know how people that are parents of teens deal with that. I would not be having that, and it does not sound fun to me.
It's not always fun. The cool thing about this book is that the interaction is like a big part of the plot, and it's cool that it's from the young people's perspective.
That is cool.
The kind of twist on that is that Eve, the narrator, is, you know, a very intelligent, very sharp, very quick-witted, well-spoken, very knowledgeable 14-year-old. And so her takes on people's interactions, her takes on the other kids' relationships with each other and things like that are really, you know, they're really sharp. Like, she makes, like, really good points. And she's able to kind of talk about climate in a really interesting way, because while they're all at this vacation home, a big storm hits. And so there's a big climate-charged hurricane that hits. It's, like, bigger than your normal storm. And so it's her observations of what the parents do. And it's kind of an interpretation of, like, while the storm is coming, the parents are just like, man, whatever. They're getting drunk. They're fucking around. They're sitting around by the fire bullshitting.
Right.
And it's, you know, I guess you could compare it to grown people now and our responsibility of being like, oh, things are getting bad with our climate. This is going to be a disaster. Bad things are coming. Bad things are happening right now. But we continue to just kind of be like, you know, whatever.
Yeah, it's not that bad.
We'll figure it out. And that kind of like passing the buck to the younger generation. And this book is kind of that view of like the younger generation being like, hey, like you knew it was coming.
Right.
why didn't you do anything about it?
Right.
That's rude and
well, they should
annoying.
Be pissed about it. They have a right to be like, I want to read this. This is actually sounds amazing, but you're getting me fired up and thinking like, good, I hope they're pissed about it, and they should be pissed at their parents about it, and they should be pissed at adults about it. Like, yeah. Don't bring me into this world and then expect me to fix it. Like, that's bullshit.
And some of the ways that they insult, it's not an insult, but it's like they kind of show this disdain for the adults in the book. It comes through in a couple ways. None of the adults are ever named. The kids all have names, and kind of their characters are described, but the adults never get named. The kids play this game where, like, they try to hide who their parents are. So, like, they don't want any of the other kids to know that, like, because there's a group of adults, right?
Yeah,
there's,
yeah.
Like, 6 or 7 adults, and then there's a group of kids, and, like, they always try to keep the identity of their parents hidden because, you know, of course, as a teenager, like, the last thing you want is someone to be like, oh, that's your dad? And you're like, oh, my
so
God.
So embarrassed.
Like, dad.
Oh, my God, why are you so embarrassing?
And, yeah, like, you want the identity of your parents to remain anonymous, of course. So, yeah. So, anyway, overall, that's what happens. The group of kids and the group of parents are at a vacation home. A huge hurricane hits, and then it's a ride from there.
Wow.
Lots of different things happen. The climate plays a huge role. Kids' relationships with adults and with each other play a huge role. It was a quick moving story. I think I really liked how it was focused on climate.
Yeah.
I really liked how it was so current with what we're currently going through.
Yeah.
I really liked how the kids were kind of the main voice of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the top thing for me was the writing. It was very well done.
Nice.
There were sections like my on the fire. You can like highlight.
Bookmarked a lot.
And I just kept highlighting these great paragraphs that I wanted to go back and
you
read
have anything
again.
To point out to us? No.
So there are two things that I wanted to highlight. So in the beginning, this is page 12, so like she's kind of describing the kids' view on things, and she says, "We respected the lake and stream, and most of all the ocean, the clouds and the earth, from whose hidden burrows and sharp grass a swarm of wasps might rise, an infestation of stinging ants, or suddenly blueberries. We respected the tree houses, an elaborate network of well-built structures high up in the forest canopy." So, she and the other kids interact really deeply with the animals and the lake.
Mm-hmm.
And the ocean, and they go swimming, and they like have tree houses, and they rescue animals, and the entire time the adults are just in the house drinking and carrying
consuming.
On and consuming. So the other part that I really liked was her description of the parents. Watching the parents in the privacy of their bedrooms at night. So like they also kind of make a game of like spying on the parents, sort of. And one of the characters does this quite a bit. "He'd been struck by the severity of their afflictions. They had fat stomachs and pendulous breasts. They had double asses that stuck out, then sagged and bulged again, protruding veins, back fat like stacks of donuts, red noses cratered by pores, black hair escaping from nostrils. We were punished by middle age, then long decrepitude."
Wow.
It's like,
oh my God, is that how kids think of us?
Is that how kids look at us? And like, how often do I just like look in the mirror? I'm like, oh my God, like, is that a gray hair? I'm balding. Like, what weird hairs are sprouting out from ears and noses and all that stuff. But just the way that it's the kids' view of the parents was an interesting twist, I thought.
How could you... I don't know. Like, that's so interesting. It just makes me think about, like... And I know this isn't... Like, I know kids also, like, completely love and adore their parents. Which they should. But how could you... I mean, thinking back to how I was as a child and a teen... And, like, all of the asshole things that I did and said. Like, the hurtful, just hurtful things that I said to my parents.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you just deal with that as a parent of having, like, kids look at you like that? Of, like, God, you're so embarrassing. I hate you. Why are you trying to ruin my life? Like, I just could not even, like, handle, like, that kind of, like, disrespect to, like, someone that you, like, brought into the war. Like, how would you even deal with that?
Yeah, and I think one thing that I liked about the book is that it doesn't explore that at all.
Okay.
Like, the parents are...
They don't get to say anything, the parents.
The parents are the ones that do the annoying things.
Yeah.
And they continuously bumble the situation.
Mm-hmm.
They trip over themselves and they say stupid stuff and mm-hmm. they treat their kids like crap. You know, which happens,
yeah,
right? And so, in a way, it's kind of like the kids are the heroes of the of the story, and I like that
what
about
a fascinating, like, plot.
Because I think
storyline.
I think too often it's like, oh, they're kids, like, they don't know what's going on. We're the grown ups. We know how to handle this,
right?
But that's not.
But guess what? No, like, I think there are probably plenty of parents who don't know, like, aren't as intelligent as their kids are, right? Like, I don't know, that's probably a really, like, not good way to say that, but I think that's not... Look at someone like Greta Thunberg, right? Like, this is what this is kind of reminding me of, is the way that she's really been... I wonder if there was some inspiration there, the way that she's really been speaking out and, like, calling out adults and politicians and, like, what are you gonna do? Like, I'm a child and I'm more, like, fired up about this and thinking about this in a more critical and intelligent way than you are. Why are you not thinking about this like mm-hmm. I am?
And I agree. And I think it also should open people's eyes to the fact that young people really do have interesting views on things.
Yeah.
And if you give them the chance and the ability to express themselves, they can say and do some really insightful things that will surprise you.
Mm-hmm.
And in this book, the things that the kids do and the ideas that they have and the way that they kind of end up being the heroes of the story is surprising because we don't get that view a lot. I thought it also kind of, like, she kind of talks a little bit about kids in the past. And the one quote I highlighted was, children who sat there learning from their teachers full of trust, secure in the knowledge that an orderly future stretched ahead of them.
Mm.
And, like, that one got me because I teach. And it's like, you know, we think of students or this institution of education as being like, yes, I'm here to learn from you, teacher. Like, mm-hmm. my future, you know, is... reliable and dependable and an orderly future stretches ahead of me. And that's not true anymore.
It's really not true.
And kids don't think that way anymore.
And yeah, they shouldn't. And they have a right to be really, like, upset with how things are going. Honestly.
Yeah. I thought it was, in keeping with the kids' insight, one of the younger characters, it's Eve's younger brother, Jack. He's kind of where the tie-ins to the Bible and to religion kind of come in.
I was wondering about that.
One of the older characters in the book gives him a small Bible in the story, and he comes at it with no knowledge about what religion is, what the Bible is.
Oh.
Like, his family isn't religious, so he reads this, you know, young person's Bible in a very, like, as it's a story.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, the various characters and things that happen in it are symbols for different things.
Huh.
Not as, like, it's the law or
the
whatever.
The truth, yeah. Or the law.
And so the other the other, if I keep reading what I highlighted, I'll just read the whole book. So you're like, well, why read it? But
audiobook as read by Steve.
He kind of talks about how heaven is
a place like, where nothing. Sorry. Go on.
Sidebar. Heaven is not like this place up in the sky, but it's, he says, it just means a good place for all of us, for us all to live. And so, like, it can be Earth. Like, heaven can be here, you know, if it's a place where we're all taken care of.
Right. Or if you're a person who doesn't believe in the afterlife or heaven, then I think you would think that heaven is a place that you need to create while you're here on Earth.
Yeah, could be. And that's, and in the story, there's a coming climate disaster, this terrible hurricane that like messes life up for a lot of people, and you know, all the electricity and all that kind of stuff. It makes you think, like with a lot of what's been going on in Texas, right? Like we all are like, those are sobering moments where it's like, geez, like we should really be more prepared for, you know, like our electricity grids are ancient, and like a lot of us don't have savings, a lot of us don't have candles or battery chargers or whatever. Like we come to just rely on what we have, and you know, that could be taken away from us,
right?
And kids are in our, like, we're responsible for them.
Yeah, exactly. That's such an interesting, god, that is such an interesting book. I'm really glad you talked about that, and I'm really glad that Robert brought it up.
Yeah, so thank you, Robert, for recommending it.
I will definitely read that. Yeah, that sounds really interesting. What an interesting perspective. It also, the part that you, I wonder if this is why we talked about this weekend, but the part where you're talking about the kids being out in nature and like really enjoying it, and are like bitching this weekend about like natural places and like natural parks and hiking and being in nature, but how every time you go there there's like 100 million people, and you, is that why you kind of thought about that, like you can't really enjoy it anyway? It's like, let's go out to nature, let's go to a national park and like really enjoy it, and it's like, well no, you can't, because there's also like 100 million people here,
right? And you drove your expedition to get there.
Big gas-guzzling car, or I mean, yeah, SUV or van or whatever. Not to shame people like that don't have a Prius, but
well, I think it's not shaming. And to take it back to the book, it's like, it's just another viewpoint on like, we should always be, you know, looking at our actions and what we do in, maybe from a perspective of someone else, you know, and like not always be just so sure that what the thing that we're doing is really good, because other and younger people might have a different perspective on it, and it's worth listening to what they have to say and not just dismissing them outright because they're young and they don't know. Other people could be like, you know, this is a great idea. You could be all into it and it's all yours, but it is worth listening to what other people think and taking, you know, their perspectives into it, because that's where the book hits hardest, is that it's a climate disaster hurricane. Ugh. And like those are happening.
They're happening
right now, and kids are like entrusting their safety to us older people
who don't have it under control.
Yeah, like, but we could be under the illusion that we're doing everything great. You know, like, hey, I recycle all my stuff. Like, I'm doing my part.
No, you know, it's like, you know what? I'm going to just stop you right there. This is a public service. Hold on. Public service announcement coming. Sorry. I don't want to, is this, we said we weren't going to apologize. I don't want this podcast to be like, oh, wow, climate change, blah, blah, blah. But like, so I'm just going to unapologetically press forward. But you really need to check yourself if you think that just because you're putting stuff into a recycling bin and putting it out onto the street or into your thing that you're like really doing a good job, because you might not be. And the reason that I know this, and this is where the public service announcement comes in, is back when we lived in Oregon, you know, people in the Pacific Northwest really do pride themselves in, like, they recycle and, like, you know, they're doing a lot for the earth, which I think they are, and I think the intentions are good. But what I came to find out when I went to a recycling, I don't want to call it a recycling class. I got schooled, basically, and I got, like, lit up by this recycling person remember when Oregon stopped doing certain kinds of plastics? I forget what the numbers were. But anyway, so the place I was working at had these folks who would come in like once a month and collect your plastics. And they schooled me. So I brought in what I thought were completely ready to go recyclables. And he went through them and picked out, I would say, at least 80% of them and was like, this isn't good. Like, these are not ready to be recycled. You need to do X, Y, and Z. You can either take them home and do it, or you can go over there to the sink with the scissors and do it. And, like, it's stuff that you would just never even think about. Like, a tofu container, one of those square tofu containers, you know how it has that, like, peel-back plastic? You have to cut the whole top off. So you have to go in under the lip and cut that whole top off, because if any of that peel-off plastic is remaining on the top, it will get thrown out.
Wow.
And like, he would pick out the most minuscule particles of food that I had thought I had completely cleaned this out. No. He was like, you need to go wash it in the sink. Like, he really... It opened my eyes to the fact that people really think that they're doing it and they're not. And so, I mean, I walk past people's recycling bins here with like a very like critical eye and just like, nope. Like, if you put a peanut butter jar in there and it has peanut butter still in it, even like a little bit, it's not, nope, it's not happening. Like, it's not getting recycled. So I think people do really need to like check themselves and like, you, like you're saying, I recycle. Do you? Because you probably are doing it wrong.
Well, I think it's could be doing it wrong and really have no idea that
well, yeah,
you are.
You don't, yeah, it's not necessarily your fault, but you are doing it wrong. If you're not taking the paper, all of the paper off of the outside of your soup can, it's not working. It's not happening.
I would also wager that, like, if we started to involve our young adults in this process of recycling, for example, and like, you know, if they were more involved in that stuff, they would probably come up with some really innovative stuff, and they are uniquely equipped to come up with fresh ideas and kind of knock us out of our preconceived notion that we're doing everything the right way,
mm-hmm.
because it's in the blue bin, it's gonna be fine. And
yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just, you know, we're guilty of it too. Like, everybody's guilty of
it.
Oh, I think
exactly.
We can all benefit from involving younger people.
We
in
really
our decisions.
Can. Yep, we really can. And even here, you know, during the pandemic and during the snow, like, most times the recycling blue bins are going right into the trash, and it's just like, well, this is, you know, a product of the pandemic, and these workers are underpaid, they don't have PPE, and they are behind schedule, and so they have to do what they can so that this city doesn't get completely overrun with trash. So you can bitch about it all you want and be like, oh my God, I can't believe it. Like, I took all the time and care to like put that stuff in a blue bin and put it out there. And like, you can get mad about it, but those people are also like putting their health on the line to like clean our trash away. And
mm-hmm.
so, I don't know. It's just sort of like what, like it, sometimes it comes down to like what's more important, you know? What are you gonna get more upset about? Like that stuff going in a landfill or this like garbage man dying from COVID?
Yeah.
Man, this is getting heavy.
It's getting heavy.
Sorry.
Robert did
say... I'm getting fired up.
Robert did say it would make for a good podcast discussion, and
Robert,
he was right.
Robert, it really did. I would be interested to hear his thoughts about the book. Like his takeaways.
Also be interested, Robert.
Yeah. Talk to us, Robert.
Talk to me, Robert.
Robert, do you want to come on the show and talk about it?
Oh, he's been invited.
Why does he decline?
He must not like us, I guess.
Oh, Robert, what?
We'll do more. Well, thanks for joining us. That was a good discussion.
That was a good discussion.
Oreo by Fran Ross. A Children's Bible by... My screen is blank. Lydia Millett.
Mm-hmm.
We'll put both of those on the Gaze Into the Blue Light podcast Goodreads page and links to them on the show notes.
I feel like we should end the show on a positive note.
You know?
Like, do we get too, like, downhill? I should bring up that we've also been watching this really weird, creepy, twisted crime show called Crime Scene about the Cecil Hotel, and it gets me so disturbed that I have to watch videos of baby otters holding hands so that I can, like, wind down and go to bed. So I'll leave you with an image of baby otters, or even adult otters, and they are just so sweet, and like they love each other so much, and they hold hands while they're floating in the stream, and then also the mother otters like hold the babies like on their belly as they float downstream. So if you're feeling upset after listening to this about climate change and the world going to hell, Google baby otters or otters holding hands. I'll leave you with that.
I'll put a link to otters holding hands video in the show notes.
It can be used for anything. It can be used after this, or if you watch something scary or anything. It's good for that.
Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
You ended on a high note.
Yep. Otters holding hands.
Okay, otters. We will talk to you next week. Adios.